man's grey eyes were bright. Not for me, the smooth agonies of adulation, of hymns and halos and self-seeking prayers, it said. I have my own agenda. Well, now you've got the key, said Dor. And I have you, said the angel. You're the opener. Without you, the key is useless. Open the door for me. You killed her family, said Richard. You've had her hunted through London below. Now you want her to open a door for you so you can single-handedly invade heaven? You're not much of a judge of character, are you? She'll never do it. The angel looked at him then, with eyes older than the Milky Way. And then it said, Ah me, and turned its back, as if it were ill-prepared to watch the unpleasantness that was about to occur.
Hurt him some more, Mr. Vandemar, said Mr. Croup. Cut off his ear.
Mr. Vandemar raised his hand. It was empty. He jerked his arm almost imperceptibly, and now he was holding a knife. Told you one day you'd find out what your own liver tastes like, he said to Richard. Today's going to be your lucky day. He slid the knife blade gently beneath Richard's earlobe. Richard felt no pain. Perhaps, he thought, he had felt too much pain already that day. Perhaps the blade was too sharp to hurt. But he felt the warm blood drip wetly from his ear down his neck. Dor was watching him, and her elfin face and huge opal-coloured eyes filled his vision. He tried to send her mental messages. Hold out! Don't let them make you do this! I'll be fine! Then Mr. Vandemar put a little pressure on the knife, and Richard began to scream.
Stop them, said Dor.
I'll open your door. Islington gestured curtly, and Mr. Vandemar sighed piteously and put his knife away. The warm blood dripped down Richard's neck and pooled and puddled in the hollow of his clavicle. Mr. Croup walked over to Dor and unlocked the right-hand manacle. She stood there, rubbing her wrist, framed by the pillars. She was still chained to the pillar on the left, but she now had a certain amount of freedom of movement. She put her hand out for the key. Remember, said Islington, I have your friends. Dor looked at him with utter contempt, every inch Lord Portico's oldest daughter. Give me the key, she said. The angel passed her the silver key.
Dor, called Richard, don't do it. Don't set it free. We don't matter.
Actually, said the Marquis, I matter very much, but I have to agree. Don't do it.
She looked from Richard to the Marquis, her eyes lingering on their manacled hands, on the heavy chains that bound them to the black iron pillars. She looked very vulnerable. And then she turned away and walked to the limit of her own chain until she stood in front of the black door made of flint and tarnished silver. There was no keyhole. She put the palm of her right hand on the door and closed her eyes, let the door tell her where it opened, what it could do, finding those places inside herself that corresponded with the door. When she pulled her hand away, there was a keyhole that had not been there before. A white light lanced out from behind the keyhole, sharp and bright as a laser in the candle-lit darkness of the hall. The girl pushed the silver key into the keyhole. There was a pause, and then she turned it in the lock. Something went click, and there was a chiming noise, and suddenly the door was framed in light.
When I am gone, said the angel, very quietly, to Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar, with charm and with kindness and with compassion. Kill them all, howsoever you wish.
It turned back to the door, which Dor was pulling open. It was opening slowly, as if there was great resistance. She was sweating.
So your employer's leaving, said the Marquis to Mr. Croup, I hope you've both been paid in full.
Krupp peered at the Marquis and said, What?
Well,
said Richard, wondering what the Marquis was trying to do, but willing to play along.
You don't think you're ever going to see him again, do you?
Mr. Vandemar blinked slowly, like an antique camera, and said, What? Mr. Krupp scratched his chin.
The corpses to be
have a point, he said to Mr. Vandemar. He walked towards the angel, who stood, arms folded, in front of the door.
Sir, it might be wise for you to settle up before you commence the next stage of your travels.
The angel turned and looked down at him as if he were less important than the least speck of dirt. Then it turned away. Richard wondered what it was contemplating.
It is of no matter now, said the angel.
Soon all the rewards your revolting little minds can conceive of will be yours when I have my throne.
Jam tomorrow, eh? Said Richard.
Don't like jam, said Mr. Vandemar. Makes me belch.
Mr. Krupp waggled a finger at Mr. Vandemar.
He's welching out on us, he said. You don't welch on Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar, me bucko. We collect our debts.
Mr. Vandemar walked over to where Mr. Krupp was standing.
In full, he said.
With interest,
barked Mr. Krupp.
And meat hooks, said Mr. Vandemar.
From heaven,
called Richard from behind them. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar walked towards the contemplative angel.
Hey,
said Mr. Krupp. The door had opened. Only a crack, but it was open. Light flooded through the crack in the door. The angel took a step forward. It was as if it were dreaming with its eyes wide open. The light from the crack in the door bathed its face, and it drank it in like wine.
Have no fear, it said, for when the vastness of creation is mine, and they gather about my throne to sing hosannas to my name, I shall reward the worthy and cast down those who are hateful in my sight.
And then it muttered something else under its breath. Richard was never certain exactly what it had said, although he later maintained it had sounded a great deal like Bloody Gabriel for a start. With an effort, Dor wrenched the black door fully open. The view through the door was blinding in its intensity, a swirling maelstrom of colour and light. Richard squinted his eyes and turned his head away from the glare, all vicious orange and retinal purple.
Is that what heaven looks like? It seems more like hell.
And then he felt the wind. A candle flew past his head and vanished through the door, and then another. And then the air was filled with candles, all spinning and tumbling through the air, heading for the light. It was as if the whole room were being sucked through the door. It was more than a wind, though. Richard knew that. His wrists began to hurt where they were manacled. It was as if, suddenly, he weighed twice as much as he ever had before. And then his perspective changed. The view through the doorway, it was looking down. It was not merely the wind that was pulling everything towards the door. It was gravity. The wind was only the air in the hall being sucked into the place on the other side of the door. He wondered what was on the other side of the door. The surface of a star? Perhaps, or the event horizon of a black hole, or something he could not even imagine. Islington grabbed hold of the pillar beside the door and held on desperately.
That's not heaven,
it shouted, grey eyes flashing spittle on its perfect lips.
You mad little witch! What have you done?
Dor was clutching the chains that held her to the black pillar, white-knuckled. There was triumph in her eyes. Mr. Vandemar had caught hold of a table leg, while Mr. Krupp, in his turn, had caught hold of Mr. Vandemar.
"It wasn't the real key,"
said Dor, triumphantly, over the roar of the wind.
"That was just a copy of the key I had Hammersmith make in the market." "But it opened the door,"
screamed the angel.
"No,"
said the girl with the opal eyes, distantly.
"I opened the door. As far and hard away as I could, I opened the door."
There was no longer any trace of kindness or compassion on the angel's face, only hatred, pure and honest and cold.
"I will kill you," it told her.
"Like you killed my family? I don't think you're going to kill anyone anymore." The angel was hanging onto the pillar with pale fingers, but its body was at a 90-degree angle to the room and was most of the way through the door. It looked both comical and dreadful. It licked its lips.
"Stop it," it pleaded. "Close the door. I'll tell you where your sister is. She's still alive."
Dor flinched. And Islington was sucked through the door, a tiny plummeting finger shrinking as it tumbled into the blinding gulf beyond. The pull was getting stronger. Richard prayed that his chains and manacles would hold. He could feel himself being sucked towards the opening, and from the corner of his eye he could see the Marquis dangling from his chains like a string puppet being sucked up by a vacuum cleaner. The table, the leg of which Mr. Vandemar was holding tightly, flew through the air and jammed in the open doorway. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar were dangling out of the door. Mr. Krupp, who was clinging, quite literally, to Mr. Vandemar's coattails, took a deep breath and began slowly to clamber hand over hand up Mr. Vandemar's back. The table creaked. Mr. Krupp looked at Dor, and he smiled like a fox on really nasty drugs.
"I killed your family," said Mr. Krupp. "Not him. And now I'm finally going to finish the..."
It was at that moment that the fabric of Mr. Vandemar's dark suit gave way. Mr. Krupp tumbled, screaming, into the void, clutching a long strip of black fabric. Mr. Vandemar looked down at the flailing figure of Mr. Krupp as it fell away from them. He, too, looked over at Dor, but there was no menace in his gaze. He shrugged, as best one can shrug while holding onto a table leg for dear life, and then he said mildly, "Bye-bye," and he let go of the table leg. Silently, he plunged through the door into the light, shrinking as he fell, heading for the tiny figure of Mr. Krupp. Soon the two shapes merged into one little blob of blackness in a sea of churning purple and white and orange light, and then the black dot, too, was gone. It made some sort of sense, Richard thought. They were a team, after all. It was getting harder to breathe. Richard felt giddy and lightheaded. The table in the doorway splintered and was sucked away through the door. One of Richard's manacles popped open, and his right arm whipped free. He grabbed the chain holding the left hand and gripped it as tightly as he could, grateful that the broken finger was on the hand that was still in the manacle. Even so, red and blue flashes of pain were shooting up his left arm. He could hear himself, distantly, shouting in pain. He could not breathe. White blotches of light exploded behind his eyes. He could feel the chain beginning to give way. The sound of the black door slamming closed filled his whole world. Richard fell violently back against the cold iron pillar and slumped to the floor. There was silence then in the hall, silence and utter darkness in the great hall under the earth. Richard closed his eyes. It made no difference to the darkness, and he opened his eyes once more. The hush was broken by the Marquis's voice asking dryly,
"So, where did you send them?"
and then Richard heard a girl's voice talking. He knew it had to be Dawes, but it sounded so young, like the voice of a tiny child at bedtime, at the end of a long and exhausting day.
I don't know. A long way away. I'm very tired now. I...
Dawes, said the Marquis, snap out of it.
It was good that he was saying it, thought Richard. Somebody had to, and Richard could no longer remember how to talk. There was a click, then, in the darkness, the sound of a manacle opening, followed by the sound of chains falling against a metal pillar, then the sound of a match being struck. A candle was lit. It burned weakly and flickered in the thin air. Fire and fleet and candlelit, thought Richard, and he could not remember why. Dawes walked unsteadily to the Marquis, holding her candle. She reached out a hand, touched his chains, and his manacles clicked open. He rubbed his wrists. Then she walked over to Richard and touched his single remaining manacle. It fell open. Dawes sighed, then, and sat down beside him. He reached out his good arm and cradled her head, holding her close to him. He rocked her slowly, back and forth, crooning a wordless lullaby. It was cold, cold, there in the Angel's empty hall. But soon the warmth of unconsciousness reached out and enveloped them both. The Marquis de Carabas watched the sleeping children. The idea of sleep, of returning even for a short time to a state so horribly close to death, scared him more than he would have ever believed. But eventually, even he put his head down on his arm and closed his eyes. And then there were none.
Chapter 18.
The Lady Serpentine, who was, but for Olympia, the oldest of the seven sisters, walked through the labyrinth beyond Down Street, her head held high, her white leather boots squashing through the dank mud. This was, after all, the furthest she had been from her house in over 100 years. Her wasp-waisted major domo, dressed from head to foot all in black leather, walked ahead of her, holding a large carriage lamp. Two of Serpentine's other women, similarly dressed, walked behind her at a respectful distance. The ripped lace train of Serpentine's dress dragged in the mire behind her, but she paid it no mind. She saw something glinting in the lamplight ahead of them, and, beside it, a dark and bulky shape.
"There it is," she said.
The two women who had been walking behind her hurried forward, splashing through the marsh, and as Serpentine's butler approached, bringing with her a swirling circle of warm light, the shapes resolved into objects. The light had been glinting from a long bronze spear. Hunter's body, twisted and bloody and wretched, lay on its back, half buried in the mud, in a large pool of scarlet gore, its legs trapped beneath the body of an enormous boar-like creature. Her eyes were closed. Serpentine's women hauled the body out from under the beast and laid it in the mud. Serpentine knelt in the wet mire and ran one finger down Hunter's cold cheek until it reached her blood-blackened lips, where she let it linger for some moments. Then she stood up.
"Bring the spear," said Serpentine.
One of the women picked up Hunter's body. The other pulled the spear from the carcass of the beast and put it over her shoulder. And then the four figures turned and went back the way they had come, a silent procession deep beneath the world. The lamplight flickered on Serpentine's ravaged face as she walked, but it revealed no emotion of any kind, neither happy nor sad.
Chapter 19.
For a moment, upon waking, he had no idea at all who he was. It was a tremendously liberating feeling, as if he were free to be whatever he wanted to be. He could be anyone at all, able to try on any identity. He could be a man or a woman, a rat or a bird, a monster or a god. And then someone made a rustling noise, and he woke up the rest of the way, and in waking he found that he was Richard Mayhew, whoever that was, whatever that meant. He was Richard Mayhew, and he did not know where he was. There was crisp linen pressed against his face. He hurt all over. In some places, the little finger on his left hand, for example, more than others. Someone was nearby. Richard could hear breathing, and the hesitant rustling noises of a person in the same room he was in, trying to be discreet. Richard raised his head, and discovered in the raising more places that hurt. Some of them hurt very badly. Far away, rooms and rooms away, people were singing. The song was so distant and quiet, he knew he would lose it if he opened his eyes, a deep, melodious chanting. He opened his eyes. The room was small and dimly lit. He was on a low bed, and the rustling sound he had heard was made by a cowled figure in a black robe, with his back to Richard. The black figure was dusting the room with an incongruously brightly coloured feather duster. "Where am I?" asked Richard. The black figure nearly dropped its feather duster. Then it turned, revealing a very nervous, thin, dark brown face. "Would you like some water?" the black friar asked, in the manner of one who has been told that if the patient wakes up, he is to be asked if he would like some water, and has been repeating it to himself over and over for the last 40 minutes to make sure that he didn't forget. And Richard realized that he was most dreadfully thirsty. He sat up in the bed. "Yes, I would. Thank you very much." The friar poured some water from a battered metal jug into a battered metal cup and passed it to Richard. Richard sipped the water slowly, restraining the impulse to gulp it down. It was crystal cold and clear and tasted like diamonds and ice. Richard looked down at himself. His clothes were gone. He had been dressed in a long robe, like one of the black friar's habits, but grey. His broken finger had been splinted and neatly bandaged. He raised a finger to his ear. There was a sticking plaster on it and what felt like stitches beneath the plaster. "You're one of the black friars," said Richard.
"Yes, sir."
"How did I get here? Where are my friends?" The friar pointed to the corridor, wordlessly and nervously. Richard got out of the bed. He checked under his grey robe. He was naked. His torso and legs were covered in a variety of deep indigo and purple bruises, all of which seemed to have been rubbed with some kind of ointment. It smelled like cough syrup and buttered toast. His right knee was bandaged. He wondered where his clothes were. There were sandals beside the bed, and he put them on. Then he walked out into the corridor. The abbot was coming down the passage towards him, holding on to the arm of Brother Fuliginus, his blind eyes pearlescent in the darkness beneath his cowl.
"You are awake, then, Richard Mayhew," said the abbot. "How do you feel?"
Richard made a face.
"My hand."
"We set your finger. It had been broken. We tended your bruises and your cuts. And you needed rest, which we gave you."
"Where's Dor? And the Marquis? How did we get here?"
"I had you brought here," said the abbot.
The two friars began to walk down the corridor, and Richard walked with them.
"Hunter," said Richard, "did you bring back her body?"
The abbot shook his head.
"There was no body. Only the beast."
"My clothes,"
They came to the door of a cell, much like the one Richard had woken in. Dor was sitting on the edge of her bed, reading a copy of Mansfield Park that Richard was certain that the friars had not previously known that they had. She also wore a grey monk's robe, which was much, much too big for her, almost comically so. She looked up as they entered.
"Hello," she said. "You've been asleep for ages. How are you feeling?"
"Fine, I think.
How are you?"
She smiled. It was not a very convincing smile.
"A bit shaky," she admitted.
There was a loud rattling in the corridor, and Richard turned to see the Marquis de Carabas being wheeled towards them in a rickety and antique wheelchair. The wheelchair was being pushed by a large black friar. Richard wondered how the Marquis managed to make being pushed around in a wheelchair look a romantic and swashbuckling thing to do. The Marquis honoured them with an enormous smile.
"Good evening, friends," he said.
"Now," said the abbot, "that you are all here, we must talk."
He led them to a large room, warmed by a roaring scrapwood fire. They arranged themselves around a table. The abbot gestured for them all to sit down. He felt for his chair and sat down in it. Then he sent Brother Fuliginus and Brother Tenebrae, who had been pushing the Marquis's bath chair, out of the room.
"So," said the abbot, "to business. Where is Islington?"
Dor shrugged. "As far away as I could send him, halfway across space and time."
"I see," said the abbot. And then he said, "Good."
"Why didn't you warn us about him?" asked Richard.
"That was not our responsibility."
Richard snorted.
"What happens now?"
he asked them all. The abbot said nothing.
"Happens? In what way?"
asked Dor.
"Well, you wanted to avenge your family, and you have. And you sent everyone involved off to some distant corner of nowhere. I mean, no one's going to try and kill you anymore, are they?"
"Not for right now," said Dor, seriously.
"And you?"
Richard asked the Marquis de Carabas.
"Have you got what you wanted?"
The Marquis nodded.
"I believe so. My debt to Lord Portico has been paid in full, and the Lady Dor owes me a significant favour."
Richard looked to Dor. She nodded.
"So, what about me?"
he asked.
"Well," said Dor, "we couldn't have done it without you." "That's not what I meant. What about getting me back home?"
The Marquis raised an eyebrow.
"Who do you think she is? The Wizard of Oz? We can't send you home. This is your home."
Dor said,
"I tried to tell you that before, Richard."
"There has to be a way,"
said Richard, and he slammed his left hand down on the table, hard for emphasis. And then he said, "Ow," because slamming your hand down on a table for emphasis is not a wise thing to do when you have a broken finger, but he said it very quietly, because he had gone through much worse.
"Where is the key?" asked the abbot.
Richard inclined his head.
"Dor," he said.
She shook her pixie head.
"I don't have it,"
she told him.
"I slipped it back into your pocket at the last market, when you brought the curry."
Richard opened his mouth, and then he closed it again. Then he opened it and said,
"You mean when I told Krupp and Vandemar that I had it, and they were welcome to search me, I had it?"
She nodded. He remembered the hard object in his back pocket on Down Street, remembered her hugging him on the ship.
"Crumbs,"
he said. The abbot reached out. His wrinkled brown fingers picked up a small bell from the table, which he shook, summoning Brother Fuliginus.
"Bring me the warrior's trousers," he said. Philogenus nodded and left.
"I'm no warrior," said Richard.
The abbot smiled gently.
"You killed the beast,"
he explained, almost regretfully.
"You are the warrior."
Richard folded his arms, exasperated.
"So after all this, I still don't get to go home, but as a consolation prize, I've made it onto some kind of archaic underground honours list?"
The Marquis looked unsympathetic.
"You can't go back to London above. A few individuals manage a kind of half-life. You met Iliaster and Lear. But that's the best you could hope for, and it isn't a good life."
Dor reached out a hand and touched Richard's arm.
"I'm sorry," she told him. "But look at all the good you've done. You got the key for us."
"Well," he asked, "what was the point of that? You just forged a new key." Brother Philogenus reappeared, carrying Richard's jeans. They were ripped and covered in mud and splashed with dried blood, and they stank. The friar handed the trousers to the abbot, who commenced to go through the pockets. Dor smiled sweetly.
"I couldn't have had Hammersmith copy it without the original," she reminded him.
The abbot cleared his throat.
"You are all very stupid people,"
he told them graciously,
"and you do not know anything at all."
He held up the silver key. It glinted in the firelight.
"Richard passed the ordeal of the key. He is its master until he returns it to our keeping. The key has power."
"It's the key to heaven," said Richard, unsure of what the abbot was getting at and what point he was trying to make.
The old man's voice was deep and melodious.
"The key is the key to all reality. If Richard wants to return to London above, then the key will take him back to London above."
"It's that simple?"
asked Richard. The old man nodded his blind head beneath the shadows of his cowl.
"Then when can we do this?"
"As soon as you are ready," said the abbot.
The friars had washed and repaired his clothes and returned them to him. Brother Philogenus led him through the abbey, up a vertiginous series of ladders and steps, up into the bell tower. There was a heavy wooden trapdoor in the top of the tower. Brother Philogenus unlocked it, and the two men pushed through it and found themselves in a narrow tunnel thickly cobwebbed with metal rungs set in the side of one wall. They climbed the rungs, going up for what seemed like thousands of feet, and came out on a dusty underground station platform. "Nightingale Lane," said the old signs on the wall. Brother Philogenus wished Richard well and told him to wait there and he would be collected, and then he clambered down the side of the wall and he was gone. Richard sat on the platform for 20 minutes. He wondered what kind of station this was. It seemed neither abandoned, like British Museum, nor real, like Blackfriars. Instead, it was a ghost station, an imaginary place, forgotten and strange. He wondered why the Marquis had not said goodbye. When Richard had asked Dor, she had said that she didn't know, but that maybe goodbyes were something else, like comforting people, at which the Marquis wasn't much good. Then she told him that she had something in her eye, and she gave him a paper with his instructions on, and she went away. Something waved from the darkness of the tunnel, something white. It was a handkerchief on a stick.
"Hello?"
called Richard. The feather-wrapped roundness of Old Bailey stepped out of the gloom, looking self-conscious and ill at ease. He was waving Richard's handkerchief, and he was sweating.
"It's me little flag,"
he said, pointing to the handkerchief.
I'm glad it's come in useful.
Old Bailey grinned uneasily.
Right, just wanted to say something I got for you. Here you go.
He thrust a hand into a coat pocket and pulled out a long black feather with a blue-purple-green sheen to it. Red thread had been wound around the quill end of the feather.
Well, thanks, said Richard, unsure of what he ought to do with it.
It's a feather, explained Old Bailey, and a good one. Memento, souvenir, keepsake, and it's free, a gift, me to you, bit of a thank you.
Yes, well, very kind of you.
Richard put it in his pocket. A warm wind blew through the tunnel. The train was coming.
This'll be your train now, said Old Bailey. I don't take trains, me. Give me a good roof any day.
He shook Richard's hand and fled. The train pulled in at the station. Its headlights were turned off, and there was nobody standing in the driver's compartment in the front. It came to a full stop. All the carriages were dark, and no doors opened. Richard knocked on the door in front of him, hoping that it was the correct one. The door gaped open, flooding the imaginary station with warm yellow light. Two small elderly gentlemen, holding long copper-coloured bugles, stepped off the train and onto the platform. Richard recognised them, Dagvard and Halvard from Earl's Court, although he could no longer recall, if he had ever known, which gentleman was which. They put their bugles to their lips and performed a ragged but sincere fanfare. Richard got onto the train and they walked in behind him. The Earl was sitting at the end of the carriage, petting the enormous Irish wolfhound. The jester, Tully, thought Richard, that was his name, stood beside him. Other than that, and the two men-at-arms, the carriage was deserted.
Who is it?
Asked the Earl.
It's him, sire, said his jester. Richard Mayhew, the one who killed the beast.
The warrior?
The Earl scratched his red-grey beard thoughtfully.
Bring him here.
Richard walked down to the Earl's chair. The Earl eyed him up and down pensively and gave no indication that he remembered ever meeting Richard before.
"Thought you'd be taller," said the Earl at length.
"Sorry."
"Well, better get on with it."
The old man stood up and addressed the empty carriage.
"Good evening. Here to honour young Mayflower. What was it the bard said?"
And then he recited in a rhythmic alliterative boom,
"A crimson the cuts in the carcass, fast falls the foe. Dauntless devout defender, bravest of boys."
"Not really a boy any more, though, is he, Tully?"
"Not particularly, Your Grace."
The Earl reached out his hand.
"Give me your sword, boy."
Richard put his hand to his belt, pulled out the knife that Hunter had given him.
"Will this do?"
he asked.
"Yes, yes,"
said the old man, taking the knife from him.
"Kneel,"
said Tully, in a stage whisper, pointing to the train floor. Richard went down on one knee. The Earl tapped him gently on each shoulder with the knife.
"Arise," he bellowed, "Sir Richard of Mayberry. With this knife I do give to you the freedom of the underside. May you be allowed to walk freely, without let or hindrance, and so on and so forth, etc., blah, blah, blah."
He trailed off, vaguely.
Thanks, said Richard. It's Mayhew, actually.
But the train was coming to a stop.
"This is where you get off," said the Earl.
He gave Richard his knife, Hunter's knife, once more, patted him on the back, and pointed toward the door. The place that Richard got off was not an underground station. It was above ground, and it reminded Richard a little of St. Pancras Station. There was something similarly oversized and mock Gothic about the architecture. But there was also a wrongness that somehow marked it as part of London below. The light was that strange, strained grey one only sees shortly before dawn. And for a few moments after sunset, the times when the world washes out into gloom and colour and distance become impossible to judge. There was a man sitting on a wooden bench watching him, and Richard approached him, cautiously, unable to tell in the murk who the man was, whether it was someone he had met before. Richard was still holding Hunter's knife, his knife. And now he gripped the hilt more tightly, for reassurance. The man looked up as Richard approached and sprang to his feet. He tugged at his forelock, something Richard had previously only seen done on television adaptations of classic novels. He looked both comical and unpleasant. Richard recognized the man as the Lord Ratspeaker.
"Well, well, yes, yes,"
said the rat speaker, agitatedly, beginning in mid-sentence.
"Just to say, the girl anesthesia, no hard feelings, the rats are your friends still, and the rat speakers, you come to us, we'll do you all right."
"Thanks," said Richard. "Anesthesia will take him," he thought. "She's expendable." The Lord Ratspeaker fumbled on the bench and presented Richard with a black vinyl zip-up sports bag. It was extremely familiar.
"It's all there. Everything. Take a look."
Richard opened the bag. All his possessions were in there, including, on the top of some neatly folded jeans, his wallet. He zipped the bag up and threw it over his shoulder and walked away from the man without a thank you or a backward glance. Richard walked out of the station and down some grey stone steps. All was silent. All was empty. Dead autumn leaves blew across the forecourt, a flurry of yellow and ochre and brown, a sudden burst of muted colour in the dim light. Richard crossed the forecourt and walked down some steps into an underpass. There was a fluttering in the half-dark, and warily he turned. There were about a dozen of them in the corridor behind him, and they slipped towards him almost silently, just a rustle of dark velvet, and, here and there, the clink of silver jewellery. The rustle of the leaves had been so much louder than these pale women. They watched him with hungry eyes. He was scared, then. He had the knife, true, but he could no more fight with it than he could jump across the Thames. He hoped that, if they attacked, he might be able to scare them away with it. He could smell honeysuckle and lily of the valley and musk. Lamia edged her way to the front of the velvets and stepped forward. Richard raised the knife nervously, remembering the chilly passion of her embrace, how pleasant it was and how cold. She smiled at him and inclined her head sweetly. Then she kissed her fingertips and blew the kiss towards Richard. He shivered. Something fluttered in the darkness of the underpass, and when he looked again, there was nothing but shadows. Through the underpass, and Richard walked up some steps and found himself at the top of a small grassy hill. It was dawn, and he could just make out details of the countryside around him, almost leafless oak and ash and beech trees, readily identifiable by the shapes of their trunks. A wide, clean river meandered gently through the green countryside. As he looked around, he realized that he was on an island of some kind. Two smaller rivers ran into the larger one, cutting him, on his little hill, off from the mainland. He knew then, without knowing how, but with total certainty, that he was still in London. But London as it had been perhaps 3,000 years ago or more, before ever the first stone of the first human habitation was laid upon a stone. He unzipped his bag and put the knife away in it, beside his wallet. Then he zipped it up again.
The sky was starting to lighten, but the light was odd. It was younger, somehow, than the sunlight he was familiar with. Purer, perhaps. An orange-red sun rose in the east, where Docklands would one day be. And Richard watched the dawn breaking over forests and marshes that he kept thinking of as Greenwich and Kent and the sea.
"Hello," said Dor.
He had not seen her approach. She was wearing different clothes beneath her battered brown leather jacket. They were still layered and ripped and patched, though, in taffeta and lace and silk and brocade. Her short red hair shone in the dawn, like burnished copper.
"Hello,"
said Richard. She stood beside him and twined her small fingers into his right hand, the hand that was holding the sports bag.
"Where are we?"
he asked.
"On the awesome and terrible island of Westminster,"
she told him. It sounded as if she were quoting from somewhere, but he did not believe he had ever heard that phrase before. They began to walk together over the long grass, wet and white with melting frost. Their footprints left a dark green trail in the grass behind them, showing where they had come from.
"Look,"
said Dor. "With the angel gone, there's a lot of sorting out to do in London below, and there's only me to do it. My father wanted to unite London below. I suppose I ought to try to finish what he started." They were walking north, away from the Thames, hand in hand. White seagulls wheeled and called in the sky above them.
"Richard, you heard what Islington said to us about keeping my sister alive, just in case. I may not be the only one of my family left, and you've saved my life more than once."
She paused, and then, all in a rush, blurted, "You've been a really good friend to me, Richard, and I've sort of got to quite like having you around. Please don't go." He squeezed her hand in his, gently.
"Well,"
he said,
"I've sort of got to quite like having you around, too. But I don't belong in this world. In my London, well, the most dangerous thing you ever have to watch out for is a taxi in a bit of a hurry. I like you, too. I like you an awful lot. But I have to go home."
She looked up at him with her odd-coloured eyes, green and blue and flame.
"Then we won't ever see each other again,"
she said.
"I suppose we won't."
"Thanks for everything you did," she said seriously. Then she threw her arms around him, and she squeezed him tightly enough that the bruises on his ribs hurt, and he hugged her back just as tightly, making all of his bruises complain violently, and he simply didn't care.
"Well," he said eventually, "it was very nice knowing you."
She was blinking hard. He wondered if she were going to tell him again that she had something in her eye. Instead, she said,
"Are you ready?"
He nodded.
"Have you got the key?"
He put down his bag and rummaged in his back pocket with his good hand. He took out the key and handed it to her. She held it out in front of her, as if it were being inserted in an imaginary door.
"Okay,"
she said. "Just walk. Don't look back." He began walking down a small hill, away from the blue waters of the Thames. A grey gull swooped past. At the bottom of the hill, he looked back. She stood at the top of the hill, silhouetted by the rising sun. Her cheeks were glistening. The orange sunlight gleamed on the key. Dor turned it with one decisive motion. The world went dark, and a low roar filled Richard's head like the maddened growling of a thousand enraged beasts. Chapter 20. The world went dark, and a low roar filled Richard's head like the maddened growling of a thousand enraged beasts.
He blinked at the darkness held tight to his bag. He wondered if he had been foolish, putting the knife away. Some people brushed past him in the dark. Richard started away from them. There were steps in front of him, which Richard began to ascend, and as he did so, the world began to resolve, to take shape, and to reform. The growling was the roar of traffic, and he was coming out of an underpass in Trafalgar Square. The sky was the perfect, untroubled blue of a television screen tuned to a dead channel. It was mid-morning on a warm October day, and he stood in the square holding his bag and blinking at the sunlight. Black taxis and red buses and multicoloured cars roared and careered about the square, while tourists threw handfuls of pigeon feed down for the legions of tubby pigeons and took their snapshots of Nelson's Column and the huge Landseer lions that flanked it. He walked through the square, wondering if he was real or not. The Japanese tourists ignored him. He tried talking to a pretty fair-haired girl who laughed and shook her head and said something in a language Richard thought might have been Italian, but was actually Finnish. There was a small child of indeterminate sex staring at some pigeons while orally demolishing a chocolate bar. He crouched down next to it.
Hello, kiddie, said Richard.
The child sucked its chocolate bar intently and gave no indication of recognizing Richard as another human being.
Hello?
Repeated Richard, a slight note of desperation creeping into his voice.
Can you see me? Kitty, hello?
Two small eyes glared at him from a chocolate-covered face. Then its lower lip began to tremble, and the child fled, throwing its arms around the legs of the nearest adult female and wailing,
"Mom, this man's bothering me. He's bothering me, Mum."
The child's mother turned on Richard with a formidable scowl.
"What are you doing?" she demanded. "Bothering our Leslie. There are places for people like you."
Richard began to smile. It was a huge and happy smile. You could not have killed that smile by hitting Richard over the back of the head with a brick.
"I really am most frightfully sorry," he said, grinning like a Cheshire cat.
And then, clutching his bag, he ran through Trafalgar Square, accompanied by bursts of sudden pigeons, who took to the air in startlement. He took his cash card out of his wallet, and he put it into the cash machine. It recognized his four-digit PIN number, advised him to keep it a secret and not disclose it to anyone, and asked what kind of service he would like. He asked for cash, and it gave him cash in abundance. He punched the air in delight and then, embarrassed, pretended that he had been hailing a cab. A cab stopped for him. It stopped for him! And he climbed in and sat in the back and beamed. He asked the driver to take him to his office. And when the cab driver pointed out that it would almost be quicker to walk, Richard grinned even wider and said he did not care. And as soon as they were underway, he asked, practically begged, the cab driver to regale him, Richard, with his opinions on inner city traffic problems, how best to deal with crime and thorny political issues of the day. The cab driver accused Richard of taking the mickey and sulked for all of the five-minute journey up the Strand. Richard did not care. He tipped the man ridiculously anyway, and then he walked into his office. As he entered the building, he felt the smile begin to leave his face. Each step he took left him more anxious, more uneasy. What if he still had no job? What did it matter if small chocolate-covered children and cab drivers could see him, if it turned out that, by some appalling mischance, he remained invisible to his workmates? Mr. Figgis, the security guard, looked up from a copy of Naughty Teenage Nymphettes, which he had hidden inside his copy of The Sun, and he sniffed. "Morning, Mr. Mayhew," he said. It was not a welcoming morning. It was a kind of mourning that implied that the speaker really did not care if the recipient lived or died, nor indeed, for that matter, if it was even mourning.
"Figgis!"
exclaimed Richard in delight. And hello to you too, Mr. Figgis, you exceptional security guard.
Nobody had ever said anything remotely like that to Mr. Figgis before, not even naked ladies in his imagination. He stared suspiciously at Richard until he got into the elevator and vanished from sight. Then he returned his attention to the naughty teenage nymphettes, none of whom, he was beginning to suspect, was ever likely to see 29 again, lollipops or no lollipops. Richard got out of the elevator and walked, slightly hesitantly, down the corridor. "Everything will be all right," he told himself, "if only my desk is there. If my desk is there, everything will be fine." He walked into the large, open-plan office he'd worked in for 3 years. People were working at desks, talking on telephones, rummaging through filing cabinets, drinking bad tea and worse coffee. It was his office. And there was the place by the window where his desk had once been, which was now occupied by a grey cluster of filing cabinets and a yucca plant. He was about to turn and run when someone handed him a cup of tea in a styrofoam cup.
"The return of the prodigal, eh?" said Gary. "Here you go."
"Hello, Gary," said Richard. "Where's my desk?"
"This way," said Gary.
"How was Mallorca?"
"Mallorca? Don't you always go to Mallorca?" asked Gary.
They were walking up the back stairs that led to the fourth floor.
"Not this time," said Richard.
"I was going to say," said Gary, "not much of a tan."
"No," agreed Richard. "Well, you know, I needed a change."
Gary nodded. He pointed to a door that had, for as long as Richard had been there, been the door to the executive files and supplies room.
"A change? Well, you've certainly got one now, and may I be the first to congratulate you."
The plaque on the door said, R.O. Mayhew, junior partner.
"Lucky bastard," said Gary, affectionately.
He wandered off, and Richard went through the door, utterly bemused. The room was no longer an executive supplies and file room. It had been emptied of files and supplies and painted in grey and black and white and recarpeted, and in the centre of the office was a large desk. He examined it. It was, unmistakably, his very own desk. His trolls had all been neatly put away in one of the desk drawers, and he took them all out and arranged them around the office. He had his own window, with a nice view of the sludge-brown river and the south bank of the Thames beyond. There was even a large green plant with huge waxy leaves of the kind that looks artificial but isn't. His old, dusty, cream-coloured computer terminal had been replaced with a much sleeker, cleaner, black computer terminal, which took up less desk space. He walked over to the window and sipped his tea, staring out to the dirty brown river.
"You found everything all right, then?"
He looked up. Crisp and efficient Sylvia, the MD's PA, was standing in the doorway. She smiled when she saw him.
Yes, look, there are things I have to take care of at home. Do you think it'd be all right if I took the rest of the day off and... Suit yourself. You aren't meant to be back in till tomorrow anyway." "I'm not?" he asked. "Right."
Sylvia frowned.
"What happened to your finger?"
"I broke it,"
he told her. She looked at his hand with concern.
"You weren't in a fight, were you?"
"Me?"
she grinned. "Just teasing. I suppose you shut it in a door. That's what my sister did."
"I know," Richard began to admit. "I was in a fight."
Sylvia raised an eyebrow. "A door," he finished, lamely. He went to the building he had once lived in by taxi. He was not sure that he trusted himself to travel by the underground. Not yet. Having no door key, he knocked at the door of his flat and was more than disappointed when it was opened by the woman
Richard last remembered meeting, or rather, failing to meet, in his bathroom. He introduced himself as the previous tenant, and quickly established that, A,